Okay, so we've gone through a few of the elementary demonstrations. We showed that del squared phi of x, right, is minus rho of x over epsilon naught. We saw that del squared 1 over the absolute value x minus x prime is minus 4 pi Dirac delta function x minus x prime. And now we're going to try to broaden the class of problems we can solve so they aren't just, as I said last time, given the charges everywhere in the world, and calculate the electrostatic potential and perhaps the electric field. But sometimes we don't know where the charges actually are, but we know other useful properties about the system, and we can try to bootstrap from those to find the solution. So usually you either know phi on surfaces, some conducting surfaces, which will be constant, or if they are, it doesn't have to be a conductor, could be an insulator or dielectric, but someone has gone out and measured phi on the surface. Or in some cases, you don't know phi, but you know the outward normal derivative on surfaces, which is like the electric field at the boundary projected onto the normal unit vector. So, to tackle this class of problems, we're going to basically begin developing the Green's function toolkit. And the first step of that is the first Green identity. And this is really an elementary identity, just provided you have two functions which are well enough behaved. Let's call those phi and psi. Then you can use this identity that I think we talked about last time, del dot phi del psi, which is in the inset of inside pages of Jackson. Or you have, maybe you all have your own favorite vector calculus reference. Somebody wants somebody. Del phi dot del psi, and then plus phi del squared psi. And so now, if we integrate this over an arbitrary volume V bounded by a closed surface S, and this could be in arbitrary dimensions, by the way, it's not just a three-dimensional theorem, then we have divergence of this phi del psi, which we can apply the over integrate over the volume. We can apply the divergence theorem to that. And get this as the complete closed surface integral enclosing V of phi del psi dotted into the outward normal on that surface. outward normal unit vector dA. And if you're in d dimensions, we would write this as d sub dx for the volume integral, and we'd write dA as d sub d minus 1x for the surface integral. And it's still true. So we often write this gradient dotted into the normal. We are going to encounter that all over the place, and it's a little more compact to write it as phi d psi d normal dA. But don't forget, if you're looking at this and wondering what that means, what it means to differentiate with respect to a unit vector, it looks a little bit weird, but it's just a shorthand notation for del psi dot n hat. Just don't forget that. Okay, so that's one side of the equality that we wanted to prove, and the other is that then this is equal to the volume integral of the right-hand side and that's the first green identity. It relates a volume integral of gradient and Laplacian on these two functions to a surface integral. And again, we really visualize having some volume V, closed surface S, bounding it. And at each point on the surface, there will be some differential element dA with an outward normal at every point on that surface.
Is there any geometrical meaning of this equation?
Geometrical meaning?
I mean, what's special about that? I mean, I didn't feel what's special about it?
Well, I guess the main geometrical meaning is goes back to the divergence theorem. Everything else is kind of trivial. Yeah, I don't know. You might want to talk to some of the general relativists in the department to ask that question. I never thought about it in geometrical language, but in a sense, it doesn't hinge on anything except the geometry, and it's true for any functions. So probably there is some geometry buried in this equation, but I'm not sure how to talk about that myself. Okay, then the second thing is sometimes called the second green identity. Or you'll also see it referred to as Green's theorem, which is going to be more relevant to what we'll do with this algebra. So basically, the second green identity is a very simple one, and you can just simply apply this equation first as I've written it, and second with phi and psi interchanged. And then subtract. And then what, of course, is going to happen is this del dot del term is going to drop out of the difference. And we will have a volume integral of phi del squared psi minus psi del squared phi integrated over the volume. If we're in three dimensions, it's d3x, the volume integral. And then that's going to equal the difference of two surface terms And again, if we're applying it in three dimensions, this will be an area integral. If this were a two-dimensional application, right, our volume would be actually an area, and our area in this integral would be the circumference, a loop integral around the circumference. And we will be doing some two-dimensional problems. Okay, so this is a great identity that we can do a lot with. It's really interesting. So again, it's valid in arbitrary dimensions, and it does not just assume a simply connected volume V and region. You can apply it to a volume V, for instance, that's bounded by two different surfaces, like have a V1 and a V2, add the volume integral over both of these surfaces, and then have their outward normals integrate over it. Can also apply to a multiply connected region, like a volume V that has holes in it. Right, and then the outward normal, of course, here on this part of the surface would look like that, but on this part of the surface it looks like that, going actually inward in this picture, but it's still outward with respect to this volume V. Okay, so the next thing we're going to do is apply this and derive an integral equation for the electrostatic potential using this lovely theorem. Again, if you came in late, sorry, I have to cancel office hours today. You can try to reach the grader, but I'm just not feeling good enough to have my office hours. I'll go home right after class. So be easy on me, okay? No really, really hard questions. I'll get depressed. Yeah.
So this applies, so psi and phi can be pretty much
any. Exactly. Now we'll specialize to some choices for it in the following that will then take us into the land of physics instead of just this math identity. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take the Poisson equation, which is a partial differential equation, and we're going to use that math over there to convert this into an integral equation for phi. And so I'm going to start with what we know. We know the Poisson equation. One thing I'm going to do is I'm going to write Poisson's equation in terms of a variable x prime. Right? I can call the independent variable anything I want, but it'll streamline the derivation a little bit if I call the independent variable x prime here. There's nothing fundamental about that. You can call it houseboat if you want. Okay, so now imagine that this rho of x has maybe two parts in the universe. Let's set up a coordinate system. I tried to sketch in the notes. We are interested in the electrostatic potential at some observation point x. And it's caused by charges at source points that I'll usually want to call x prime. But now again, remember this equation introduces an imaginary volume V. It does not have to correspond to anything real in the world, just like a Gaussian surface. So I want to maybe draw a volume V here, And it includes part of the charges in the universe, but maybe not all. Let's say there are some that are inside of V, and maybe some that are outside of V. And what I want to do is consider both cases, both look at cases where the observation point is outside of the volume V and where the observation point is inside of the volume V. And we'll see some interesting things from those two different cases. They'll tell us different amounts of information. Okay, so here is where the derivation will go. We're going to use Green's theorem with a particular choice of phi and psi. So I'll let little phi become our electrostatic potential. And I will let little psi be 1 over the absolute value of x minus x prime, which we know is a relevant function to electrostatics, right? Okay. So in Green's theorem, I'm going to let prime coordinates be my integration variables. And I will also be using in this derivation what we showed earlier, that del prime squared psi is minus 4 pi Dirac delta function. So now we're just going to plug all that into Green's theorem and see what does it say. So let's write that out. Any questions? You see my logic. Okay, so let's put it all together. I think I need to upgrade the chalk situation here. I don't remember if they put some in drawers. Oh, cool. That's what I need. Thanks. Okay. So, integral over this volume V, we decided to choose as our volume to consider this integral. Then I claim phi of x prime, del prime squared of 1 over absolute x minus x prime, minus 1 over absolute x minus x prime, del prime squared phi of x prime. There's the volume integral part of Green's theorem. And now that has to equal a difference of two surface integrals over the closed surface S bounding this volume V. So we have phi of x prime d by dn prime, 1 over the absolute x minus x prime, minus 1 over the absolute value x minus x prime, not differentiated, times the normal derivative of phi with respect to the primed coordinates on the surface. Okay, so various terms now we can insert. Here is setting a delta function, so that integral is going to be really easy to do. Right? There is setting minus 4 pi delta x minus x prime. And here, because we're applying this to a real physical problem now, where phi is the electrostatic potential, and del squared phi is minus rho of x prime over epsilon naught. So we can plug in those simplifications. And there's one more that we worked out previously that we can also write out this normal derivative as n hat prime dotted into x minus x prime over x minus x prime cubed.
That's just doing that derivative.
Yeah. Okay, so just to simplify the notation a little bit, I'm going to call a distance r that frequently occurs in here, the distance between the x prime at any given volume point in the integral or surface point. If the vector from that to x, its length is r absolute x minus x prime, which is occurring a lot in our notation. So it'll save a little writing if I introduce this. Okay, and now basically there are two different cases, as I indicated over here, we have to consider. We have to consider a case where x, the observation point, is inside our volume V, and a case where it's outside our volume V. So, where do I want to go? Maybe I'll go here. So let's do first look at observation points inside of this volume V. And then we have that this integral of phi of x prime times minus 4 pi delta of x minus x prime, since x is inside the volume V, I claim that minus 4 pi, the volume integral, phi of x prime, delta of x minus x prime, d cubed x prime, that's just minus 4 pi, phi of x, which is actually what our goal is, to find the integral equation for phi of x. So there is the unknown quantity is going to be one of the four terms in this equation, at least in this first case where x is inside of V. And now that equals, if I collect all the other terms, that equals minus 1 over epsilon naught, the volume integral of rho of x prime, d cubed x prime over the absolute x minus x prime, which I could have called r. Yeah, but then you have to remember it depends on both x and x prime. And then plus the surface terms, phi of x prime, d by dn prime, 1 over r, minus 1 over r d by dn prime, phi of x prime, all integrated dA prime. So if we divide both sides by the 4 pi, actually minus 4 pi, then I cancel out the minus 4 pi there, and I get 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught here. And I get a minus 1 over 4 pi here. And that's our integral equation for phi. But don't forget, this integral only includes these charges inside of V, right? Because this, we're doing this integral for the volume. So we have to only include, when we add up these charges, it would only be the rho inside of V. And we would not include rho outside. And so you might wonder, how is that physics of the charges outside of our totally imaginary volume, V, how is that built into this physics of this equation? And the point is that the effect of all of these charges outside our volume V, that the point is that that's encapsulated by the values of phi and d phi dn on the surface. So to solve this problem, you can just totally forget about these charges, but now someone's going to have to tell you what are phi and or d phi dn on this surface. And that will be equivalent knowledge to like making our volume V bigger and like making it the all space and integrating in this integral over the outside charges as well, which would then be inside. Does any of that make any sense at all? Yeah.
Can we then do a volume integral over no charges and then just know the boundary condition on the surface?
Can we do the volume integral what? Just over the make, you mean make this our volume V?
No, like make the volume V so that V, rho in and rho out are not within V. And then if we knew the potential on the surface, would that seem fine?
Yeah, that's also true. If there's, there might be no charges inside and this term is zero. Yeah. And then it's still valid.
Is it different to the previous formula? In this formula, there's an integral over all space, right?
Do you mean the Green theorem? What do you mean by the previous formula? Oh, when we wrote that, yeah. Then the volume V was infinite space, and then we had to include all charges. Well, they're equivalent except one might be much easier or harder to apply than the other. Again, if there is a conductor here, you don't know where those charges are. Okay. So that's just to summarize this first part, part one, where X vector lies inside our volume V. And that's the case I was just going to come to, which you already pointed out, that if there are no charges inside V, then phi of X everywhere inside V will be determined entirely by the surface information on phi and the derivative of phi. This actually is a slight problem because in the mathematical literature for solutions of this type of partial differential equation, which is now converted to an integral equation, equivalent in principle, that this is called Cauchy boundary conditions on a partial differential equation like this. If you specify on a surface both the derivative and the function, that is Cauchy boundary conditions. Some partial differential equations allow that, but actually the one we are solving in electrostatics does not. This would over-specify the solution and lead to inconsistency if someone goes out, okay, with their voltmeter, measures phi and d phi dn, plugs it into this integral to calculate phi at some point inside of V. This overspecifies the solution, and one would find in general an inconsistency from doing that. So we'll discuss that later. For now, I just wanted to point out that this is a something of a problem that we'll have to be aware of and take steps to eliminate this overspecification. Okay, the second case, which we haven't talked about yet, is what if the observation point is outside of the volume V? So we can do these integrals again. But if we integrate over all x prime inside of V and x lies outside of V, this delta function is no longer going to equal minus 4 pi delta phi of x. It's going to be 0, right? Because the delta function is only non-zero when x equals x prime, and we never actually hit that point if x is outside of the volume we're integrating over. And actually, the discussion of this case is the only case I have found, I think, where Jackson makes an error in his writing. First, let me say the equation I get then. So now the main difference is this integral, instead of equaling minus 4 pi phi, this is equaling 0. And so now we have a different equation. 0 must be 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. Integral of V of rho, the rho, of course, only inside of V. Then the surface terms. And so you see that actually this equation tells you nothing whatsoever about phi of x outside. Outside of the volume V we chose to implement Green's theorem. So what I am saying was an error in Jackson is, I wrote this in the notes. If you're interested, it's not such a big deal. But he writes that this result for this case gives zero field and zero potential outside the volume V. But I claim it does not give zero potential and zero field. It simply tells you nothing whatsoever about the field outside of V. Yeah.
So when we pick psi of 1 over x minus x prime, like, what does that, like, do for us? Like, is there a way, do we know that that determines, like, all phi of x? Because, like, that's, I guess what I'm asking, is that choice of function arbitrary?
Well, we haven't proved the uniqueness. I mean, later we will prove that if you can find one solution, then it's guaranteed to be unique, and no matter how you found that solution, it means it is the solution.
But I guess what I mean is, like, when we started, we picked the potential, and we picked one of them. What if I just picked x?
Well, then it wouldn't tell you anything. There would never be a row of arising in the equation.
So we need the 1 over x specifically for the charge.
Yeah, because we want to be able to get this term to come out. Did you have a comment?
Well, I mean, what it really does for us is when it hits us, when we hit it with the Laplace, it becomes a delta function, and then it picks out our potential at a single point, if the point was inside the volume.
For sure, but my question is, if you do it with that, like, you really have shown that you can solve for any phi of x.
Right, if you picked a different function, it would be a function phi of x you've calculated, but it would have nothing to do with the electrostatic potential. Okay, so anyway, the first time I taught this course in Colorado, I wrote to Jackson about this, and he wouldn't admit that there was a problem with it, but I think maybe he had stopped caring. He's gotten a lot of royalties from that book. And he died in 2016, so now he can't defend himself. Okay, let me say some things about the variational formulation, which is, in fact, one of the methods that's really used in practice to solve these kinds of equations. And there are big codes you can find on the internet to calculate electrostatics, like using finite element methods. And most of those are equations in those methods are derived from this variational formulation. So let me pick a functional that I know will work. Functional, I'll call it I of phi. Which is defined as follows. A half the volume integral of del phi dot del phi. Over a volume V. Minus volume integral of rho over epsilon naught times phi d cubed x. And I claim that it's not too hard, and I will prove it now, that this is a variational expression. A variational principle which can actually be used to determine phi. And let me explain how you do that and why it's a variational principle. So the way if you're given an expression like this, right, then you're interested in letting phi vary somewhat from the exact phi that obeys all the boundary conditions and Poisson's equation. Plus some small change to the function, small change delta phi. Okay, so what we want to do is insert this phi exact plus delta phi into here and see how much I of phi changes. Requires that we do some differentiation. So to first order, I of phi plus delta phi. Now I'm going to leave off the exact subscript on phi, but you should remember wherever you see a plane phi, that means this exact solution. Phi plus delta phi Right.
When you say, solution is what?
Of Poisson's equation.
Okay.
With that row and this phi would be the solution of that. Right, so this would equal I of phi plus the first order variation, delta I. And delta I is the volume integral then of del phi dotted into del of delta phi over the volume minus rho over epsilon naught delta phi d cubed x, standard sort of variational calculation you've all, I think, encountered in your classical mechanics. And now if we apply Green's first identity, then I claim it gives that the first order variation is the volume integral over V of minus del squared phi minus rho over epsilon naught delta phi d cubed x, and then but plus a surface term of d phi dn delta phi dA. Okay, so this is clearly zero, because remember phi is, we said at the outset, that is the exact solution of Poisson's equation. So this integral is zero for arbitrary variations delta phi. And this surface term might concern you because it's not automatically going to be zero. But we can actually force it to be zero if we demand that our trial functions, our variations that we're considering, these delta phi, that these all obey the desired physical boundary conditions on the surface. So what you can do to actually use this is simply plug in some trial expression for phi. It depends on, usually it depends on some parameters. Sometimes it has no parameters. It would be the simplest case. But ideally there would be one or more parameters, and you would find the value of those parameters that gives a stationary value of this variational functional. And that should give you, within the class of trial functions you considered, that should give you the most accurate approximation to the real potential that you can get for that class of trial functions you chose. Now, that seems like a completely different strategy than what we've talked about before, where we were just doing integrals and so on, surface and volume integrals to get exact expressions. But it is useful, especially if you have a very flexible trial function that can essentially represent any physical behavior of phi, then you can get really very accurate results this way. Uh, part of what leads to some of the more arcane and tricky methods of, yeah, you had a question. Right, I only collected the first order terms. I think the term you're talking about would not be first order.
So when you have a delta I, those are the first order terms and the perturbation.
Right.
Not delta times the original.
Right, right, yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's the variational derivative language, the first variational derivative with respect to the functional. Yeah, it has this structure. In fact, you see this in a lot of quantum problems. You see this del phi dot or del psi dot del psi structure in like scattering theory, variational principles. Okay, let's come to uniqueness. And the subject of this is basically we're trying to find the minimum amount of information that will uniquely specify the solution. And again, let's suppose there is a volume V lurking out there. And then I can start from the equation we had before, 5x, the volume integral of rho. I should make this x prime so we don't confuse it with the observation point. And then the surface terms. Integrate over the area, dA prime. And as I argued before, although I didn't really prove it, and I don't really want to get into the proof, if you really are interested in why Cauchy boundary conditions are over-specifying the problem, I would suggest you look at Morrison-Feshbach, Volume 1, which has a rather detailed discussion of that and what types of PDEs these are actually appropriate for. So as I said, or claimed at least, without proof, if you really specify phi and d phi dn, that's actually too much information and leads to an ill-formed mathematical problem that will have inconsistencies in general in the solution. And to get around that problem, we will consider normally one of two different possibilities for how we're going to pick the boundary conditions to specify an electrostatics problem. One is to specify or have it measured, it might be measured in an experiment, phi of x on the surface. These are the so-called Dirichlet boundary conditions. This is an important word, Dirichlet, both now and when we get into the Dirichlet-Green's function. And so this word needs to leap out at you when you see this word, that this boundary condition means that phi of x is specified on the surface. And a special case is you'll sometimes see phi of x is specified on a surface and it is zero on a surface. This would be like a grounded conductor. Then these are called, just terminology, homogeneous Dirichlet. Boundary conditions. So this is one class of solutions that's totally well-defined, and we'll actually be using this one mostly. The second possibility is that only the derivative is specified, not phi, but only d phi dn is specified. Like someone gets out and measures the electric field at the surface. Then you would be doing the second type, and these are called Neumann boundary conditions. And again, if it's zero, it would be homogeneous Neumann boundary conditions. And so let me state the result of this theorem and then try to convince you that it's true. Which is that if you know rho inside a volume V, again, an arbitrary imaginary volume, and either Dirichlet or Neumann boundary conditions, but not both, so you're given either the potential on the surface or the normal derivative of the potential at the surface, then this is enough to specify phi inside V uniquely. And this is important because now you can try to find it using any method, these tricky methods like conformal mapping for two-dimensional problems, which I'm not planning to cover, but you can see covered in many E&M books, or the method of images, which seems tricky. You pretend there are charges outside of V that you just arrange to fit boundary conditions. If you can get the solution inside of V by any method that is consistent with the boundary conditions, then you know you can stop. You don't have to say, oh, well, this is a solution, but are there other solutions? You don't have to do that because of this theorem. And the proof is not so hard. You can just imagine that there are two solutions, phi 1 and phi 2. and these obey, first of all, del squared for each of them is equal to minus rho over epsilon naught inside V. And for the Dirichlet case, phi 1 equals phi 2 on S. That's the Dirichlet version of this proof. Or for the Neumann version, d phi 1d normal on S equals d phi 2 normal on S. That would be the Neumann case. So let's suppose we had two such solutions, and now we can define the difference between them, which I want to analyze. I'll call that function U, defined to be phi 1 minus phi 2. Okay, so now we know that if you make phi 1 minus phi 2, it's going to obey Laplace's equation. The rho will cancel out. When you subtract the Poisson equation for phi 1 from the Poisson equation from phi 2, So I claim del squared u equals 0. And not only that, but also u is equal to 0 on the surface for the Dirichlet case, or du dn is 0 on S for the Neumann case. And so now let me write the first green identity again. See what that tells us. And I'm going to apply it with phi equal to u now, and also psi equal to u. So what do I have? I have the volume integral of u del squared u plus del u dot del u in my volume integral. And that's equal to the surface integral of u du dn integrated over the surface bounding V. And we already said that del squared u is 0. And so, in fact, we have, and these are 0, one or the other is 0, u will be 0 if it's Dirichlet case, du dn will be 0 if it's the Neumann case. So in either case, the surface integral vanishes, and we've shown that the volume integral of del u squared integrated over volume, and it's an arbitrary volume, that volume integral is 0. No matter how we choose it, for either Dirichlet or Neumann boundary conditions. And so the only way this can all be consistent is if del u is 0 everywhere inside the volume V. And that in turn implies that u, which is phi 1 minus phi 2, would have to be constant throughout the volume V. And that we know is equivalent to saying that they are the same potential, because you can change the potential by a constant without changing any of the fields. Let's see, I'm not sure I got your point. Yeah, for the Dirichlet case, I think it's guaranteed already that that constant is zero. But for the Neumann case, I think it is not. But they'll give the same electric field. And in that sense, it's unique. Yeah.
Can you give us a case where we don't have a unique solution?
Well, I just proved that there isn't one. I mean, I guess perhaps if both U and DUDN, if those are, but then you have two solutions that would obey different boundary conditions. So it's not really the spirit of the uniqueness theorem. You could get different solutions if you have different boundary conditions, of course. Well, sometimes there are multiple linearly independent solutions, like in scattering theory. I guess in that sense, it's not a unique solution to Schrodinger's equation, right? Just for a square well that you're going to scatter in, you can either send in particles from the left or you could send in particles from the right. Those are two different solutions at a given energy E. So that's a solution case where there is not a unique solution. But there is some, in this case, two linearly independent solutions. It's a little different than the spirit of the uniqueness theorem, so I'm not sure that's a really great example. But certainly when you get into nonlinear equations like the Gross-Podievsky equation, some of you heard of that in Bose-Einstein condensation theory, it has a term in the Schrodinger equation that looks like a constant times psi cubed. And it's an approximate equation, but it's coming out of mean field theory, but it's actually pretty accurate, pretty successful theory. If G is negative, you can get the condensate to implode on itself and a lot of complicated physics, and I think those solutions might not be unique. But the non-uniqueness in that case comes down to the mean field approximation, which you should try to do better than that. Well, I mentioned in the notes not only Morrison-Feshbach volume 1, if you want to see why Cauchy boundary conditions are problematic, you can also look at Arfkin and Weber, which is a useful book of mathematical physics. Okay, so these are all kind of some preliminaries. Now we are ready to start really laying the foundation for systematic how to tackle these problems using Green's functions. So let me get started on that in the remaining 10 minutes. And this is really going to take us the next few weeks to really implement this in a systematic way. And we'll be implementing it for Poisson's equation, which we're solving here, but later it'll be useful when we do radiation theory and things like that. Okay, but I'm going to specialize this initial discussion and try not only to get across the math, but the physics implied by these equations. Okay, so this method is especially useful for a couple of different problems, which are not so unusual, are really common problems in the field. We might be given the potentials on a boundary surface S. And or we might be given charge distribution rho in some region inside of a conducting boundary. But these are really simple ideas, and they are hinging on the linearity of the PDEs that we're trying to solve. Okay, so the point is that you can represent rho, if you like, as like a delta function at this point, and a delta function at every point inside here. And if you can find the electrostatic potential due to one of these, okay, then you can find it due to all of them, and you simply have to add them up, weighting it by rho at that point, because of the linear nature of the equations. Another example I like to invoke at this point, which I think adds a little insight, is, you know, there are engineers at Boeing Aircraft. Sorry, Boeing's having hard times these days. Who are measuring Green's function. That's their job, okay? And what do? They have like a wing and attached to a fuselage. Well, now I have to draw a wing, don't I? I don't know how to draw a wing. Anyway, so what they'll do is they'll apply a unit force to some point on the wing, and they'll see how the rest of the aircraft distorts. So this is like the X prime, the source point where you've added an impulsive unit, very localized force, and now you measure G of X, X prime, the distortion of the whole airplane at every point on the airplane. And from that, you can then calculate what happens in the more complex situation in the approximation that it's still linear physics. So that's kind of the main point here, is the linearity means we can break down the problem to finding in our case, the electrostatic potential due to a delta function at a point. It has to be an arbitrary point that could be anywhere in our volume V. But once we've got that, we will have reduced the problem to quadrature. If someone changes the charge distribution on us, then you just have to do a new integral, but using the same Green's function, unless they change the boundary conditions or something. Okay, so that's all a bit abstract. It'll be more clear and concrete when I write the equations. Okay, so in our context, we will view our Green's function as the electrostatic potential at X, our observation point, caused by a single point charge at x prime. And I'll call it a, quote, unit point charge. At x prime. So it'll have to depend on two vectors. It's a six, if we're in three dimensions, this is a six-dimensional object. And so if G is a potential, except for the epsilon naught, okay. So in the old days, in Gaussian units, it really was exactly as this is written. But now since Jackson has changed to SI units in the first half of his book, which are even now the old SI units, now G is not strictly speaking the potential. It doesn't have the 1 over epsilon naught stuff in it. But just as he did in when he was doing it in Gaussian units, we'll keep the same defining equation for the Green's function. It will obey del squared g of xx prime is minus 4 pi Dirac delta function x minus x prime. Right? That says there's a point charge, rho of x is a point charge centered at the point x prime. And now we already know a particular solution of this inhomogeneous differential equation. It's not the most general solution we'll need, but it's worth keeping in mind that a particular solution is just 1 over the magnitude of x minus x prime. This we know obeys this equation. Since del squared 1 over x minus x prime is minus 4 pi that delta function. We showed that earlier. But to write the most general solution, we have to add the general solution of the homogeneous equation as well. And so I can write that this way, g of x, x prime, then we know it will equal a particular solution of the inhomogeneous equation, like you always have when you have linear inhomogeneous equations. You can take a particular inhomogeneous solution, add that to the general homogeneous solution, and I'll call capital F of x, x prime that general solution. Because this obeys the homogeneous equation. Namely, del squared f of x prime must be 0 everywhere in our volume V. So next time we will figure out how to choose this F. And one way will be this method of images. A lot of you probably saw when you were undergraduates learning E&M. You can pick F by introducing fake charges. They have to lie outside the volume V. But as long as you do put them outside the volume V you care about, you can mimic boundary conditions on V surface by fake image charges.